Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Professor David Katz of the University of Massachusetts, who assesses the rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine and the danger that the U.S. and NATO could be drawn into the nation's escalating civil war. Law Professor Vernilia Randall, who discusses the divisive issues laid bare in the police shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and the possibility that this latest incident in a pattern of police abuse could inspire a new civil rights movement. And Tom Torres of the group Hands Off Appalachia, who talks about how a three-year campaign helped push Swiss banking giant UBS to pull back from investments in mountaintop removal coal mining. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Clashes erupted in a Monrovia, Liberia slum as police enforced a mandatory quarantine of the capital city's West Point neighborhood. Angry youths threw rocks at the police, who reacted by firing live rounds into crowds of residents. The violence capped off a week of unrest over the outbreak of Ebola in Liberia, when the government took aggressive steps to contain the disease, which has killed over 1,400 people in West Africa, one of the world's poorest regions. Officials had converted a primary school into an Ebola holding center without informing the community. Soon afterwards, residents looted the center, stealing generators and supplies, including mattresses, some of which were infected with the Ebola virus. Africa's current Ebola outbreak, the worst since 1976, has spread quickly to cities including Monrovia and Guinea's capital city, Conakry. The local health systems have quickly collapsed as health workers became ill and died and hospitals closed. Now, few community residents have access to basic health care such as treatment for malaria. Already, West Africa's Ebola epidemic has inflicted serious economic damage. In Sierra Leone, checkpoints and quarantines have shut down most economic activity, including agriculture, where a delay in cultivation of crops could lead to dangerous food shortages. Despite criticism from right-wing think tanks, corrections experts believe the expansion of Medicaid under the federal Affordable Care Act will lead to lower rates of prison recidivism as ex-offenders gain access to mental health services. A 2010 study by the Washington State Institute for Public Policy found arrest rates fell by 33% when former inmates enrolled in Medicaid and received substance abuse treatment. Today, more than 1 million prisoners suffer from mental illness, and substance abuse impacts three-quarters of all inmates. In Chicago, the county jail began enrolling inmates in Medicaid last fall. Now, Cook County receives federal funds totaling more than $632 a month for each Medicaid patient. At the same time, the number of uninsured Chicago residents fell by 11%. Steve Glass of the Cook County Health and Hospital Systems observed, "The Affordable Care Act has given public health systems a level of stability it has not seen in decades." He noted that city government is now able to provide services to the broad community, as well as inmates leaving Cook County Jail. Sexual assault is chronically underreported by most police departments as a result of poorly trained emergency phone dispatchers misclassifying initial reports of assault and law enforcement management downgrading rape cases. According to a detailed report by University of Kansas Law School professor Corey Rayburn Young, over 1 million rape cases went unreported to the FBI from 1995 to 2012. But Professor Young believes that number is likely much higher. In 2013, Human Rights Watch documented systemic failures in the Washington, D.C. Police Department in handling rape cases. Similarly, an external audit of the New Orleans Police Department found that 46% of sexual assault cases were misclassified. Researchers believe that many police departments have underestimated the number of sexual assault cases because victims were perceived as belonging to fringe populations that included prostitutes, runaways, transgender women, and drug addicts. Racial bias is also a factor in underreporting rape. Native American women suffer from the highest rates of rape per capita in the nation. When they file complaints of sexual assault, police often question them aggressively about their history of mental illness and alcohol abuse. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
An offensive by Ukraine's military in recent weeks has succeeded in recapturing territory once held by pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. According to the United Nations, the country's civil war has claimed the lives of more than 2,000 people and wounded 5,000 in eastern Ukraine since the conflict began in April. Civilian casualties have increased in recent weeks as Kiev's army has advanced into the region's major cities. 298 people died in mid-July when a Malaysian airliner was shot down over the region that was suspected to have been brought down by pro-Russian rebels who had accidentally targeted the passenger jet with a Russian-made ground-to-air missile. Tensions have recently further increased with charges by Ukraine's government, the U.S., and NATO that Russia has fired artillery from both inside and outside their border, targeting Ukrainian soldiers. Moscow has also been condemned for sending in hundreds of trucks carrying humanitarian aid destined for civilians caught in the war zone without Kiev's authorization. Ukraine's leaders charge that the aid trucks have covertly delivered military equipment to the rebels, an accusation that Moscow denies. Just before inconclusive peace talks got underway on August 26 between Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko and Russian President Vladimir Putin in the Belarus capital of Minsk, Ukraine reported that it had captured 10 Russian paratroopers on Ukrainian territory, which they asserted was proof of Russia's interference in the conflict. But Russian state media said that the soldiers had crossed the border by mistake. Your reporter spoke with David Kotz, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who assesses the rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine and the danger that the U.S. and NATO could be drawn into the nation's escalating civil war.
At the present time, there's a very sharp military conflict going on. As those who follow the news know, Russian-speaking people in southeastern Ukraine took power from the authorities based in Kiev after this uprising in February. And in the city of Donetsk, in Luhansk, these are big cities in southeastern Ukraine, in the Donbas region it's called, these rebels didn't agree with the new regime in Kiev, and their demands mainly seem to be respecting the rights of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers in Ukraine and some decentralization of power in the country. For a while, they had a ceasefire agreement after some initial fighting. And about a month ago, I guess it is now, the Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, who had been elected a while after this seizure of power in Kiev, announced that he was going to end the ceasefire. And since then, there's been an offensive by the Ukrainian government against the parts of Ukraine that are held by rebels against that government. And it's been a very bloody battle. The Ukrainian government forces have been bombing and shelling big cities. More than 2,000 people have been killed in that section of Ukraine. Apartment buildings, hospitals, schools have been destroyed. It's very costly. There's been largely a cutoff of supplies of water, power, telephone service in the big cities in that region. The Ukrainian government kept bombing and shelling. Russia then announced they were going to send a relief mission of over 200 trucks, which they said were filled with relief supplies. They tried to negotiate with the Ukrainian government to allow these relief supplies in. They were never able to get an agreement, and so just the other day, they sent a convoy of some 200 trucks. For some reason, the United States and the EU called this an invasion of relief trucks. The relief trucks came to Luhansk. They unloaded their cargo of food and water and other supplies, and then they went back. So they went back to Russia. So that's where we are at the moment.
David Kotz, says, as you look at what's going on, what is the potential for a direct conflict between Russia and Ukraine and the danger that such a conflict could quickly draw in the U.S. and NATO?
It's a serious danger. It's not likely that a war will develop between the U.S. and NATO on one side and Russia on the other. But it's not impossible. You know, it's hard to know, you know, who is doing what. The Ukrainian government and the United States government both charge that Russia has been sending supplies and personnel to the rebels in southeastern Ukraine. They charge that Russia has been firing missiles and artillery from inside Russia. The Russian government denies all of this. It does seem almost certain that Russia has been supporting the rebels in various ways, while trying not to create even greater anger on the part of the U.S. and the EU. The problem is that the seizure of power in February by this right-wing group represented, I think, to the U.S. government, an opportunity to finally pull Ukraine away from Russia, forcing it to choose to ultimately become part of NATO. I think that's the aim.
Professor Kotz, if Russia's main concern here is a Ukraine aligned with NATO and Russia's decades-long worry about being surrounded by NATO states on its eastern front, could not the solution to this conflict be some kind of neutrality guarantee for the state of Ukraine? And what is the response of the Obama administration and the European Union when it comes to that central concern of Russia, which could be a key to de-escalation here?
Well, they just want to roll over it. If you look at what the Russian government has said they favor, it is something exactly like that, that they want the rights of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers. We're not exactly the same group. The Russian speakers are more numerous than those who identify as ethnic Russian in Ukraine. They want their rights respected. They would like some decentralization of power to the regions in Ukraine. And they would like Ukraine to be neutral between the two sides, to not join an alliance. Whereas our government, unfortunately, seems determined to get Ukraine to join an alliance. So the only solution that I can see to this is if the U.S. government comes to its senses and realizes it's just not in the cards to pull Ukraine away from Russia and agrees to some kind of neutral position for Ukraine. I think that would satisfy all sides, and the problem could be fairly readily resolved in that case.
That was David Kotz, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and co-author of the book, Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, The Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia. For more analysis on the crisis in Ukraine, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After 2 weeks of protest, militarized police response, and street violence in Ferguson, Missouri, the body of Michael Brown, the unarmed 18-year-old African-American shot to death by a white police officer, was laid to rest after an emotional funeral ceremony attended by thousands. Among those speaking at the funeral were civil rights leader Reverend Al Sharpton and family members who called for justice in the case, expressing the desire by many in Ferguson for the police officer who shot Brown, Darren Wilson, to be indicted for murder. A grand jury is now weighing evidence in the case, and a federal investigation is also underway. Eric Davis, Michael Brown's cousin, urged those attending the funeral to vote in local elections and push for change, declaring that the community has had enough of senseless killings. While Ferguson's population is two-thirds African American, the mayor and five of the six members of the city council are white. The town's 53-member police department notably employs only three African American officers. New evidence in the case emerged on August 25th, when an audio recording was produced by a man who lives in an apartment building near the site of the shooting. The audio recorded in a video chat reportedly captures the sound of as many as 11 gunshots being fired in the August 9th incident. An independent autopsy found that Brown was shot six times, twice in the head. Your reporter spoke with Vernelia Randall, emeritus professor of law at the University of Dayton, Ohio, who discusses the divisive issues laid bare in the police shooting death of Michael Brown, and the possibility that this latest incident and a pattern of police abuse in minority communities could inspire a new civil rights movement.
What has happened since the 80s is a rolling back on racial progress. And it's been a consistent rolling back and development of a new system of oppression. And I think that the anger that is seen is not just because of police brutality, that is, but because of the recognition that it's all part of a complete system that the people in Ferguson and across the United States have been suffering from. Here in Dayton, if you're talking about police, we had a shooting of an unarmed man here just a few days before Michael Brown was shot and killed. So I think the experience of racism and segregation and discrimination that this murder of this young man has kind of like the tipping point for a lot of people in the country.
Is what we've seen with the public response to the police shooting of Michael Brown capable of sparking a sustainable national movement to seriously ignite a national debate on the best ways to address police abuse issues? As many have, I think, aptly named this thing, they've been saying that we need a movement and not just another moment.
I think that's exactly right. What we need is not a debate on what needs to be done. We know what needs to be done. The issue is whether we have the will to do it and whether the people who lead us have the will to do it. And if there's going to be a movement, the movement should be on forcing people who are in the authority to take a step towards doing something, not engaging in discussion on what needs to be done.
Professor Randall, could you briefly describe what are the essential things you believe this nation needs to do in terms of policy change or action within these individual police departments?
First of all, I think there's an overall policy change that we need to stop defining discrimination as just intent, because that means we leave out negligent discrimination. And I taught criminal law and tort law and discrimination law. And in criminal law and tort law, people can be held responsible for things they didn't intend. Discrimination law is the only area of personal injury where we say, oh, the person had to intend it. And if they didn't intend it, they can't be held responsible. I think a lot of the problems we have in this country as African Americans and discrimination is because we no longer have a law that really addresses that. And specifically on police, no one is collecting data. No one is held accountable. So both at the state level and the federal level, one thing that could be done is to tie money to instances of police brutality so that departments and cities will begin to pay more attention to it.
Professor Randall, we have seen a lot of young people become involved in bringing attention to police abuse, both in the tragic shooting of Michael Brown and the cases that came before it, Eric Garner and Trayvon Martin. I wonder if we're seeing develop here a new civil rights movement made up of young people to make it their own. What do you think?
I hope so. And I hope they call it something other than civil rights, because it needs to be much bigger than civil rights. It's about human rights. And when I look at John Crawford here in Beaver Creek, Ohio, right, a suburb outside of Dayton, was a 22-year-old man who went into Walmart's and picked up a toy gun, and some white woman got scared, said he looked dangerous. And the police got involved, and before they could figure out that it was a toy gun that he was holding, they had killed him. The protest that is being lodged in this community is being led by young people. It's being led by people in their 20s and their 30s. And I hope it does spark something continuous, and that it will focus on the bigger human rights beyond police brutality. The right to food, to education, to housing, to a decent education, to a living wage, to be free of racism, sexism, and homophobia. I hope the people are engaged in that kind of movement.
That was Vernelia Randall, Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of Dayton, Ohio. Find links to more news and commentary on the Michael Brown shooting and police abuse by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.com. In November 2013, 14 activists were arrested for challenging the role financial services company UBS plays in mountaintop removal coal mining. Their protest action took place at the U.S. headquarters of UBS in Stamford, Connecticut. One group of activists scaled a crane and unfurled a banner which read, "UBS stop funding mountaintop removal," while others locked themselves to a railing inside the headquarters' main entrance. Over the past few years, UBS has moved away from its earlier unqualified support for companies engaged in mountaintop removal coal mining that blows the tops off mountain ridges and dumps the debris into valley streams below. The mining method results in massive air and water pollution. Several studies have shown a significantly higher incidence of some cancers and birth defects among residents of communities located in coal mining areas where this extreme energy extraction practice is in use. The Swiss banking giant's actions over the past several months make it clear that UBS no longer thinks investment in mountaintop removal is a good business decision, apart from ethical concerns. In a statement to the local Stamford Advocate newspaper, Karina Byrne, a spokesperson for UBS Americas, said the company fully acknowledges the importance of mining to the global economy. At the same time, it also recognizes the potential environmental, social, and human rights impact of this industry sector. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tom Torres, an organizer with Hands Off Appalachia, the group which organized the UPS protest action in Stamford last November. Here he describes his group's ongoing campaign to stop mountaintop removal coal mining and his reaction to the recent UBS announcement.
Throughout 2013, Hands Off Appalachia had a series of escalating actions against UBS and targeting their financial support of mountaintop removal. And so in the early spring, we had a lot of regional actions in the south, in the southeast and in Appalachia. And then in May, we escalated our campaign in Knoxville, Tennessee, to arrestables where three activists with Hands Off Appalachia got arrested in the protest in Knoxville, Tennessee, where Hands Off Appalachia started the campaign. And then in June, a group that we worked with, Capitalism Versus the Climate, did a solidarity action with us in Stamford, Connecticut, where activists were arrested in the protest at the UBS Americas headquarters. And so the work that we were doing in Connecticut with the Action Camp was built off of that escalating series of actions that we had been planning all year.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of UBS's involvement with mountaintop removal coal mining, or MTR?
In 2010, UBS facilitated the merger of Alpha and Massey, which created the largest mountaintop removal company in the country. And then between 2009 and 2010, UBS gave $1.4 billion to three coal companies that engage in mountaintop removal: Alpha Natural Resources, Arch Coal, and James River Coal. And then in 2011, Rainforest Action Network, in their mountaintop removal scorecard, ranked UBS as the world's top funder of mountaintop removal. That's the major stuff with UBS historically.
Can you summarize what action, or maybe lack of action, UBS has taken recently regarding its financing of mountaintop removal?
The Hands Off Appalachia victory wasn't a recent decision that UBS publicly made. It's been a series of actions that they've been taking over the past 2 years, but especially over the several months since our action camp in November and the Stanford actions that came out of it. In 2010, UBS released a statement against MTR, but the statement we feel is inadequate and really vague with no real accountability in place. And so it just states their commitment to reducing their exposure to companies that engage in mountaintop removal, but beyond that doesn't have any way to hold them accountable, and no specific numbers or targets or goals or timelines. And so we've been bringing that up and having that be a big part of our campaign. And during the Stanford action, our demands of that week were for them to put out a stronger statement, because we had seen them kind of take some steps back. Like, they hadn't actively funded anyone in a while, in a few months. And so we're like, okay, maybe this is an opportunity to push for this, for them to release a stronger statement. And so we ended up meeting with executives of UBS, like their global head of social and environmental risk, the global head of sustainability, people like that. And we had an hour and a half meeting with UBS and went through the policy line by line and then talked about our issues with it and then different opportunities for them to strengthen that. And we walked out of that meeting. We didn't get the statement that we wanted. And so then we did these actions. But over the past few months, we've seen them not participate in loans with the companies that they had historically engaged with. We've seen them downgrade coal companies that they've previously funded from past years. And so we feel that the statement itself isn't sufficient to prevent them from engaging in mountaintop removal financing. The actions that they've taken recently show us their commitment to doing that. We feel that's a big win for the movement.
Tom Torres, is Hands Off Appalachia asking anything else of UBS, or are you moving on to other targets?
Yeah, it would be great if UBS would release a stronger statement, and there's going to be some stuff around that. But as far as the campaign is concerned, everyone's working on different projects right now. The way it was shaping out was after the actions, we were considering what our next steps look like. And so there were different talks around an International Day of Action as a logical next step for our campaign when we got the news of what's been going on with UBS. And so since then, we've been working on other campaigns because this is a really big win for the movement, but this isn't the win that we need for the fight against strip mining and mountaintop removal. And so we're working on different campaigns as well beyond the UBS Hands Off Appalachia campaign.
You know, sometimes the biggest punishment for these kinds of nonviolent direct actions is all the times that people have to return to court. In the case of the UBS 14, they had to travel from Appalachia to Stamford, Connecticut, pretty much every month since last November, only to be given another continuance. Can you say where the legal situation stands now?
Everyone's in kind of in a different place in terms of resolution. And so, like, one member, like, about a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, one of the 14 people who got arrested in Stamford got cleared of everything. And so all the stuff they need to do with court is over. And other folks are getting to that point. Other folks are expecting a little bit longer in this process. It depends on their level of participation in it. The court stuff from the November actions is still happening, so people are still having to go up there kind of regularly.
That was Tom Torres, an organizer with the group Hands Off Appalachia. For more information on the campaign targeting UBS investments in mountaintop removal coal mining, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.